This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear a segment of a presentation given by Palestinian Iyad Bernat, who is the head of the Berlin Popular Committee in occupied Palestine.
This isn't Gaza. This is the West Bank, where every day Israel gobbles up more and more land. But there's popular resistance in the West Bank and in Gaza.
We'll hear about a side of President John F. Kennedy that few knew about.
That he was taking steps to end the Cold War, get out of Vietnam, had back channels with Khrushchev and Castro, and that's why he was killed. All this is in James W. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Welcome, listeners, to Law and Disorder. I'm here with Michael Ratner in Ratner's basement, actually. Why? Hurricane Sandy knocked out the electricity and the phones on Wall Street, where the WBAI studios are. We normally record there. It's still out. We've been reduced to the subterranean broadcast. Michael, nice to see you in your basement.
Good to see you, Michael. My basement has lots of artifacts of Michael's and my lives in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. The one we're looking at right now is eight pictures. They're wanted posters in which eight members of the Bush administration are holding those little signs in front of them like you do when you're put in a police station. So there's Alberto Gonzalez, and then there's a date on the sign, and the date is when he did something really bad, you know, like authorized waterboarding. And then there's George Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Rove. So far, none of them are in jail, but this is, you know, hope eternal. So here we are in the basement with the other guys who were in the basement.
Well, let's talk about a good guy, Michael. Jeremy Hammond. You and I were in court on November 22nd for Jeremy Hammond's bail hearing. We're going to talk about how that went. Hint, not good. But first, Michael, explain what Jeremy Hammond is alleged to have done and why it's so important.
Michael and I were in court for his bail hearing. Michael, since his kid went off and became a famous musician, has an extra room, and Michael had generously offered that extra room to Jeremy if and when he gets out on bail. We're still hopeful, but yesterday wasn't exactly a cause for hope. But Michael asked about Jeremy Hammond. Sometimes he's referred to as the electronic Robin Hood, and there was a recent long piece on him in Rolling Stone, which is whatever you want to learn about Jeremy Hammond. It's an important article. If you look at this, the three people who at least I'm involved with in some way or another, of course, I represent WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and then the people who allegedly uploaded material to WikiLeaks are Bradley Manning, who I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of, the young private who's on trial at Fort Meade in a court-martial for uploading Cablegate, which are the State Department cables, along with Iraq war logs, collateral murder video. And then there's Jeremy Hammond, who is less well-known to a lot of people, but should be well-known, because what he did was extraordinary. And what he did was with a group called, I'm not sure the name of the group, allegedly with a group called Anonymous, but various names, LulzZ, whatever, LulzSec, whatever they're called, AntiSec, whatever the names were, he was able to get into what are called the Stratfor emails.
Well, that's what they're accusing him of doing.
Right. The Stratfor emails are 5 million, I think, emails and other parts of Stratfor that is a private intelligence company. And what does a private intelligence company do, Michael?
You know, I mean, if you thought about it for just 1 second, you'd realize that if an outfit like that didn't exist, it should have, and it certainly does, because Stratfor spies on citizens and countries, but privately, and then sells its information to various corporations and other people that use its services. It's the largest private intelligence company on the planet, and Jeremy Hammond is alleged to have hacked his way in to their computer file and uploaded the stuff he got to WikiLeaks.
Now, of course, like any private intelligence company, it has close connections to U.S. government. So the head of the division that did a lot of this stuff was formerly, it's called the Diplomatic Security Services, I think. It's part of the State Department. It's what investigates their leaks, and so for example, that is currently investigating, that unit is investigating WikiLeaks. But, of course, the former head of that unit, or at least one of the people, is now at Stratford. Now, Michael said they cracked into Stratford and allegedly cracked into it, at least Jeremy did. And, of course, some of the documents are quite extraordinary. There was the one that, of course, we focused on immediately, which was that there's a sealed indictment against Julian Assange. May or may not be true, but they were bragging about having seen it, or there was a sealed indictment, et cetera, against my client, Julian Assange. There were also documents about their spying. They spied on, I think, Dow Chemical, which in some way was, I think, took over the company, or was the company that was involved in the Bhopal massacre, all the, the spilling of all the toxics that killed thousands of people in India. They were involved in spying on PETA, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, and involved on spying on the very group, interestingly, that eventually cracked them, according to the government, Anonymous. So they did a lot of this spying on activist groups, and they would furnish corporations as well as the Israeli army, apparently, with information about people. So this is what Anonymous allegedly did. Jeremy Hammond allegedly was one of the important people in doing this. They indicted Jeremy Hammond, and they arrested him in March of 2012. He's been at Metropolitan Correctional Center, where Michael Smith and I have visited him, for about, since March, so eight months.
8 months, yeah.
And he's not had bail set. He's in there, and he's charged in the indictment with cracking into the Stratford emails. They caught him, to the extent you believe anything, because one of the people in his group, a man named Sabu, was turned into a FBI informant. And then much of what was done after that was really at the behest of the FBI.
With Sabu still working with Jeremy Hammond, but actually working for the government.
Right. So Jeremy Hammond did some very, if he did this stuff, he did some very heroic stuff. The material is very, very important. And it's been used throughout the world, really, to talk about what the U.S. does, what Israel does, what's done by private security. So there we are. That's the broad outlines. And on November 20th, which is Tuesday last week, Michael Smith and I go into court. And it's a courthouse, federal court. And Michael and I are dressed in our suits. And there's about 30 or 40 people supporting Jeremy, which was great. And there were people from all over the country.
Well, Jeremy's from Chicago, right. Friends from Philadelphia.
Tennessee.
One woman who said she was like a second mother to Jeremy came from the Appalachian Mountains in Tennessee. I wonder when they showed up, boy, what a shot in the arm it was. About 30 young people,
Right, Guy Fawkes pictures in the middle. And then they had on Free Jeremy Hammond. And underneath, like, something we will not forget, with a great Anonymous expression. So they all showed up. So it was a good support in the courtroom. It was a very formal business, and particularly in federal court. It's all these wooden paneled courtrooms, an American flag, a judge raised up above you, defense counsel, which are Liz Fink, Margie Ratner Kunstler, Sarah Kunstler, and a couple of other people were at the table. Emily Kunstler was there as a paralegal. So a lot of effort has been made for Jeremy Hammond. As I said, Michael Smith and I visited him in prison. And Jeremy came into the room. He looked very good. He has a small beard, dressed in a blue jumpsuit, gave a big smile to his supporters, looked very, very good. And then the hearing happened, which took about an hour and a half, a long hearing on bail. And just to introduce that, to get bail, the government has the burden of showing that you shouldn't get bail. It's up to the government to prove why shouldn't this person be out on bail, because they haven't been convicted.
Well, what's the policy here, Michael? What underlies the policy on bail?
Bail is that you haven't been convicted of anything, so you should be out on the street.
For two reasons. One is punishment, and secondly, you have to be able to be out there to help defend yourself and prepare your defense and work with your attorneys. Otherwise, it violates the Sixth Amendment.
Right, and the two factors for bail are, one, the government has to prove that you will abscond. In other words, that you will not come back to court and face trial. And the other thing they have the burden of proof on is that you're a danger to the community. And so the hearing was really about those two factors. Michael, you sat there. They actually had Michael stand up at a point to say that here's the respectable lawyer, Michael Smith, where Jeremy Hammond will be residing.
I was introduced as being a member of the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's how Liz Fink presented it. It didn't seem to weigh even as a feather in the scales for this judge. Loretta Preska, when she got through with us, one of the attorneys commented that with her, they don't need a prosecutor.
In any case, the hearing went on. And I agree with Michael. It was a very hostile hearing. The main thing is that at the end of an hour and a half hearing, the judge reads her decision denying bail, and it was obvious that it had been prepared way in advance.
And one of the first things that Attorney Liz Fink said was, "Your Honor, I can't prepare a defense of this man without access to all the files that he allegedly uploaded. And I can't figure them out from that. There's so many hundreds of thousands of them, and I'm not good at computers, and I can't figure them out. And I can't just go into the jail where he's being held. There's no real facilities for us to figure them out, he and I together. He's got to be free in order for us to work together with all these files so I can adequately defend him. I'm telling you, Your Honor, I can't do the job I've been assigned by this court to do and defend this client without access to these files, and I can't do it in the jail where he's being held." Well, what was her reaction to that?
Her reaction to that is, well, we have lots of cases with huge files of computers. It's been done before. They had jailer there. She had him stand up and say, talk about access, because Jeremy Hammond's lawyers were complaining, it takes us hours to get in. They won't even give him a computer, even offline. He can't get access to anything. And basically she said, well, we're going to cure all this. And he said, of course, we'll cure all this. And I can guarantee that they will be back in court again and again, because I can guarantee they will never have the time or adequate computers to work on their defense in that prison. The other issue was that Liz, the lawyer for Jeremy Hammond, said the only way we can work on the files is if we're there with him. He's not allowed to work on the files himself, even if he's offline. Judge said, well, we can fix that. So I presume they're going to fix that so Jeremy Hammond can have access to his own files. But we'll see. I don't know. I mean, the judge was just making it up as she went along, because it's clearly almost impossible, if not impossible, to prepare this case. So one of the reasons they said we need him out on bail was because to prepare the case. The other reason is, of course, he hasn't been convicted, so he should be out. So then they get to the two factors. The first is he going to flee if he gets out?
So the judge, very hostile by this point, telling Liz, I don't like your tone of voice, and so on. Liz Fink says to the judge, first of all, he doesn't have a passport. Secondly, his parents are putting up their home for bail. Third, he's a political person. He's not looking to flee. He's looking to bring the issues here involving Stratford into the public spotlight. And he's never not shown up for any previous court appearances. He's not going anywhere. And moreover, Judge, I'm an officer of the court, and so is Mr. Smith, and so are the people that are sitting at counsel table. We're not going to let him flee. We'll tell the marshal if he flees. We need to work with him. We can't prepare his defense if he's still in jail. So what did the judge say to that, Michael?
The judge did give reasons why she thought that he was a flight risk. The reason she said was, one, is this is a much longer sentence that he faces than he faced in the last charge. He did get 2 years a few years ago for another computer hacking, and he was out on bail during that. And so the point was, he didn't flee then. Why is he going to flee now? And she says, well, this is a longer sentence. He can get, and this is amazing, for this alleged crime, he can get 39 and a half years.
Yeah, and you know what? It seemed to me that she'd give him every day of that.
I worry about it. I worry a lot about him in this case. I'm really worried about it, because it would be an outrage if he got something like that. But this country is really being punitive about computer hacking, from Bradley Manning to Julian Assange and now to Jeremy Hammond.
Computer hacking, Michael, when it comes to threatening to expose the secrets of this government's illegal activity, not so punitive when it comes to sex offenders. That was the ironic point, because
they're freed all the time.
Sarah Kunstler said they're freed all the time and given access to computers. Therefore, if they're freed, why shouldn't our white-collar attacker be freed? You can make an order that he shouldn't use a computer.
So on risk of flight, she basically said the sentence was a key factor. But the second thing was really disturbing. This one, I know Michael will be disturbed by this. The second one was that he flaunts legal authority.
Doesn't respect authority.
Right, doesn't accept legal authority. Of course, he is an anarchist, I think.
By definition.
Right, so he doesn't. And what are the examples? Well, some of them were like perhaps one BS occasion or two where he failed to go to his probation officer a few years ago.
One.
But he actually showed up, and he showed up probably scores of times for the probation officer. So once he didn't show up, or once was late for something, you know, whatever it was like garbage. But the big one was he smokes marijuana.
Every other day.
Every other day. And he was actually had smoked marijuana on the day he was arrested. And so I thought about that for a while. This means he flaunts legal authority. So do half the people in the United States. So does everybody in the state of Washington who voted to legalize marijuana. They all flaunt legal authority. And this is serious? This is why you're not letting Jeremy Hammond out on bail? Because he smokes marijuana and therefore flaunts legal authority and therefore he won't obey an order to return to court? I mean, this has got to be one of the most garbagey positions I've ever heard in a federal court.
This judge is afraid of him. That was obvious. She sees him as a menace to society, her society.
Right. I mean, she did give a lot of kudos to his talents as a computer hacker. But there's other people too. So she was just making her point that she considers him, as you said, Michael. She considers this guy to be a danger. So that's the first point. So that's on risk of flight. And I have to tell you, Michael, sitting here, you and I, there's not any question Jeremy will show up. It's ridiculous, not only because of his mother's house, but that's the way he's been. And he's staying here, and he's staying here to fight what he considers to be illegal governmental actions.
Yeah, but when Liz Fink raised that point, the judge creamed her when she said, this is a political trial. I don't want to hear that.
So his risk of flight was just BS by the judge. Now, the second one is danger to the community. Michael, weigh in there.
I think the judge sincerely believes that this person is an ongoing menace and that he would continue his, quote, crimes if he ever got out on bail. She said, well, even if he stays at Mr. Smith's house and then goes over to the law office to prepare his defense, he could stop at an internet cafe, couldn't he? Sarah Kunstler said, well, I guess he could, but you could time this, you know, to see how long it takes to get from one place to the other. If it takes longer, do something about it. You could tell him not to come near a computer. You could put an electronic monitor on him. There's a lot of stuff right. You could do.
And they do that often, Sarah said. When they stay with Michael Smith, and then he has to go to Sarah Kunstler and Liz Fink's office, the parole or whatever, the probation thing or whatever, actually knows how long it takes, and that's all he's allowed to be out on the street. Doesn't have time to go stop there. It's not like he just presses a button and he gets into someone's computer. I mean, this is like a big days and hours of work. This is like an evening. The judge thinks this guy has magical powers. I think she thinks that even without a computer, he can crack a computer. And that's the way she sounded.
Now, she was utterly frightened of him. Standing there really as a protector of the status quo and of what the government is doing, wanting to make sure that none of that's going to get exposed.
So his danger to the community was that if he was released, he could somehow get to a computer, it would be online, and he could damage somebody somewhere. You know, whether it's whatever it is, you know, some bank's records, you know, some other private security company, the CIA. You know, this guy's done some great stuff in his career. The jail time he did before was for cracking some very conservative website. But he also got time, or at least suspended sentence, for burning the Olympic flag with a whole group of people. He didn't actually burn it in protest. There was a Holocaust denier in town or somewhere, Chicago or Arizona, and he did a protest against the Holocaust denier. So this Jeremy Hammond, interesting guy, good, interesting politics, does great stuff, and then he had a judge who just prepared the opinion before, and you could have talked to a wall.
I think she was so excessive that she may get overturned on appeal. At least it's worth taking a shot. And that's exactly what Liz Fink, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, and Sarah Kunstler are doing. Even as we're speaking, they're going to cut off their Thanksgiving vacation to work on the papers, take an appeal on this.
So we encourage our listeners to go to the Free Jeremy Hammond website. Please do that. Support Jeremy Hammond. He's an important figure as we go forward in our efforts to lift the veil of government secrecy and demonstrate the government's incredible corruption and criminality. In our show last week, we discussed the recent onslaught by Israel against Gaza, which was just beginning. Sadly, as we talk here again a week later, it's going on. What do you make of what's happening there?
Why are they doing it? Why have they already killed about 139 people, including 20-some children, wounded some 900? It's kind of a repeat of what happened exactly 4 years ago. People are puzzled by that. The most logical explanation, I think, is that it helps Netanyahu in his reelection bid next month. And I think that's probably what it is. You know, they're so really genocidally minded against the Palestinians that they call it mowing the lawn. The United States underwrites this. It gives Israel $3 billion worth of aid every year, including arms. And I think that another explanation may be that the arms they're giving them have to be used, and there's money in the pipeline. And that would be something that somebody should investigate and look into. But I'm very suspicious that that monetary gain is also somewhere involved in here.
I mean, I don't know the timeline well enough, and it goes back and forth. You know, but there is, of course, the argument that there is the argument that you referred to in Mow the Grass. What they mean by mow the grass is every few years, Hamas gets strong enough so that they have some rockets and they have, you know, nothing compared, obviously, an ant compared to the sledgehammer of the Israeli military, but that they have to make sure that they can wipe out whatever rockets Gaza has. And their rockets are getting a little more advanced. And so they go in there every 4 years or 3 years and they, quote, mow the grass. Mowing the grass is getting rid of every Palestinian who is like a leader, progressive in the community, getting rid of the rockets if they can, so they can keep the status quo and just keep gobbling up Israel, Palestinian land throughout the period. Look at the rockets. You know, you can't just send rockets over civilian places and hopefully they'll land on a military, which they don't. I mean, they're a pinprick compared to what Israel does, but they do give Israel this excuse that they use to say we're going to go in and liquidate as much as we can.
That's the point, because Israel needed an excuse. It provoked this one by assassinating Ahmed Jabari, who was the military head of Hamas, even as Jabari was trying to fashion truce with the Israelis. And
the Israeli Gideon Baskin was negotiating with Jabari or through another intermediary with Jabari for making things better, a ceasefire. And he actually got Gilead Shalit out through Jabari, and the Israelis then kill him.
Yeah. Well, they killed him on purpose to provoke this, provide cover. If you want to, your timeline should go all the way back to 1948. 80% of the people living in Gaza used to live in Israel proper and were kicked out of their homes, and their land was confiscated. And the ultimate reason for the Gaza resistance is that they're a colonized people living in a vast open-air prison, terrible, terrible lives. Gazans haven't even recovered from the destruction of the civilian infrastructure 4 years ago, and the Israelis now are bombing the police stations and the hospitals and the governmental administrative stations and the schools and the roads, and they're going to make as miserable as life was for those people, who the Israelis make sure get only enough calories to sustain their life and not to die.
Right.
Because of the embargo.
People should understand there's an embargo, and Israel only allows enough food through so that people can sustain their life. For all of you listeners who had hopes that Obama would somehow make it better in his second term for the Palestinians, abandon all hope, ye who had those hopes. Because he has allowed now, according to even the New York Times, almost no space between the position of Netanyahu, the president, the prime minister of Israel, and himself. He's utterly supported this bombing of Gaza. There's been no ground invasion yet. Hopefully there won't be. But Obama has utterly supported it, not even asked for restraint in it. And doesn't seem to me that Obama is going to be any different. I never thought there was any different in his second term than he was in his first term. And you should also understand these, as Michael said earlier, Michael Smith, these attacks are facilitated by U.S. weapons. That's what they are. That's what they use. And it may be, you know, there's a new film coming out. It's called The Lab. It's about how Israel prolongs these conflicts because they're the third biggest arms seller in the world right now, number three. And what they do, what no other country has, is they have an ability to test these weapons and how they're used in the occupied territories and in Gaza. This thesis of this new film and some writing that's coming out is they actually test these weapons. So if you see that now they're using white phosphorus, which is not completely illegal, but in my view, it's completely illegal. But they're using white phosphorus in certain situations. Most likely, it's a test for how to use white phosphorus.
And the other thing I think they're testing is they have what's called the Iron Dome.
That financed completely by Obama. Iron Dome, Obama.
Iron Dome, what does that mean? It's the Israeli defense system. And I think that they're experimenting by first provoking the people in Gaza and getting rockets rained down on them. They're experimenting and trying to defend against those rockets, because if they do bomb Iran and the Iranians retaliate, and the Iranians have a lot more juice to retaliate with than the people in the Gaza Strip. But if the Iranians retaliate and send missiles at Israel, the Israelis want to make sure that their Iron Dome protects them from that. And I think that
sounds really right. Because if they were to attack Iran, they would have to have a very good tested system of anti-missile defense. And it may well be that they're doing that. Because if you read the tweets, I actually subscribe now to the tweets of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces.
My hat's off to you, Michael. I couldn't do it.
A little IDF shield appears on the tweets, but they brag about how many of the missiles, or the rockets, rather, the rockets from Gaza, that they're able to shoot down through Iron Dome. It's a big part of their tweets. So it makes sense to me what you're saying, that they're trying to perfect a system of anti-missile defense.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a recent presentation by Palestinian Iyad Bernat, head of the Berlin Popular Committee and a leader of the village's nonviolent popular resistant movement. Since 2005, citizens of Berlin have held weekly demonstrations against the building of the Israeli separation wall through the community's agricultural lands and the steady encroachment of illegal settlements. The demonstrators are joined by Israeli and international peace activists and have maintained a commitment to nonviolent methods of resistance in spite of armed military opposition by the Israelis that's resulted in many injuries and some deaths. These demonstrations are the subject of a recent award-winning documentary film called Five Broken Cameras, which was made by Iyad's brother, Imad Bernat. Let's go to the speech.
Good evening, everybody. I am Iyad Bernat, the head of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlement in Belaim, and also a member in steering committee in West Bank, leading the nonviolent resistance against the occupation. So here I want to talk today about our nonviolent struggle in West Bank and Palestinian nonviolent struggle. You know today what happened in Gaza, just in a quick. The Israelis bombed Gaza before the elections, and it's happened every time. When they have elections, they kill more Palestinians. So if Netanyahu kill more Palestinians, he will be win. I think this is the suffering of the Palestinian people. Destroyed lands, destroyed the life of the Palestinian to build apartheid state. And here I want to talk about the nonviolent resistance, and to take my village as example of the nonviolent resistance in West Bank. You know, the nonviolent resistance, it doesn't start in Belaim village or in Na'lin. We have the nonviolent resistance from 1936 against the British occupation, and it was 6 months, intifada for 6 months against the British occupation. 1987 started the first intifada, and also it was non-violent intifada. So always the violent coming from the Israeli army. I remember in that time I was 15 years old. When I was 17, I've been arrested for 2 years. And you didn't know how the situation that the prisoners live in it in that time. When they take me from my home at middle of the night, a big group of soldiers, and I was just a child in the school. I lost my school also because of this. They take me to Dahriya jail. And they put me in 21 days in bad situation. This is just example what they're doing against the prisoners when they arrested them. and I leave this bad situation. The first day, they take all our clothes. And I remember in 1992, it was very cold in February and snow in Palestine. So they put me outside in the cold all the day. At night, they take me to small room. Small room, it's not room. It's half and half meter. So I have to stand all the night. And why? They want me to sign on a paper. They write it in Hebrew language. And I didn't know Hebrew. And I didn't know what's in this paper. Still, this situation, 21 days. After this, I have to sign. So when they take me to the court, I find that I am a member in Fatah Party. I didn't know in that time what's Fatah Party or other parties, because you know all the Palestinian was going in the demonstrations and they didn't know anything about the parties. And we was children, just participating in the school demonstrations. And they said that I was throwing stones. They take me from my home at middle of the night. I was sleeping. Maybe my dream was throwing stones. I didn't know. So I spent 2 years in the desert, in the Nakab jail. And that is, they built this jail for the people who arrested them in the first intifada. And it's very bad jail. I find there 20,000 people in this jail, and most of them is the children. So in 2000, started the second intifada. And you know, the Israelis attacked the cities and they destroyed everything for the Palestinian Authority in that time. 2003, they was knowing that the media and everybody looking what happened in the cities and in Palestinian area. So they started to build the apartheid wall, what they called it security wall. So some villages before Belayin was fighting this wall, but nobody know about them because all the media was just looking what happened in the cities and what the Israelis was killing every day people and attack and demolish and everything. 2004, December, they started in Belayin village. So Belayin people, when they saw the bulldozer destroyed, there is olive trees and there is land, and most of the people is the farmers.
That was Iyad Bernat recently speaking here in New York about the popular resistance in his Belayin community against the Israeli separation wall.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today, we speak with James W. Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. The essence of this extraordinarily well-researched and documented book, I would say the best book on this topic, is that Kennedy had changed his mind about being a cold warrior, was trying to turn things around, and that it was elements in the CIA and the military establishment that had him assassinated. We're delighted to have with us longtime peace activist, author,
Catholic theologian James W. Douglas. Jim, in contrast to, say, Cheney, who said with respect to the Vietnam War when he dodged it that he had better things to do, or Bush, who played hooky from the Air National Guard when his dad got him into that. John F. Kennedy was in World War II. He knew what war was about. He was a real war hero, actually. And your book starts out talking about his experiences in World War II. Talk to us about that.
I think that those experiences are, as you've already indicated, Michael, a foundation for his presidency. He was in the South Pacific. Of course, he volunteered, and he wanted to go into the war. He wanted to accept responsibility for the fighting. And he was, as everybody knows, sort of on his PT boat. But what happened on that PT boat when it got split into two, one midnight, by a Japanese destroyer is the real story. And he lost brothers, he lost people he loved at that time. And he also had this extraordinary experience when he was saving other people's lives of being adrift overnight, really, in the midst of the ocean, trying to alert other PT boats to the problems of his brothers. And during that experience, he both drew a deep distrust of military authority because he saw what they did not do and what they did do in negative ways in the war. And secondly, he basically, I think, was given a mission during that time of trying to end war. And he had the opportunity when he became president of the United States.
That's really the heart of this book, New. Why did Kennedy die?
Yes.
And if you understand that, you understand the forces behind his assassination.
Yes.
And that's what we'd like to talk to you about. Let's talk about how it all unfolded. He got into office, and right away he was faced with the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yes.
And what was his conclusion with respect to the CIA when he got involved in that situation?
Well, he said very specifically, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds." He felt that he had been lied to, manipulated, and set up, I should underline, by the CIA. They knew that what they were telling him was false, that there was going to be an internal revolution when the exiles landed. They knew that wasn't going to happen. They even had the terrain messed up in his mind. They thought they could convince him that the exiles could go into the kind of terrain where they could hold out on the edge of Cuba. All of this was false. And the point was to put him in a position where he would have to call in U.S. troops in order not to take a loss as a young president. And they thought inconceivable that he would. Well, they were wrong, as Kennedy said to his friends. "They had me figured all wrong, and he took the loss rather than do what he said he would never do, which was send in U.S. troops. He would no more send in U.S. troops in Cuba than he would in Vietnam." He always drew the line at that. "I will not send in U.S. combat troops." He wouldn't do it in Cuba. He wouldn't do it in Vietnam.
Jim, can you talk a bit about what you call Kennedy's vision and also explain what you mean in the title by the unspeakable?
Well, to begin with the unspeakable, because that's sort of the backdrop of the book, that comes from Thomas Merton, a monk, spiritual writer, and a friend also, who wrote a book called Raids on the Unspeakable. And he meant by the unspeakable the kind of evil whose depth and deceit seems to go beyond the capacity of words to describe. And it was in the midst of the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the assassinations of the Kennedys and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King that he used that term. Kennedy's vision is articulated especially in the American University Address, June 10, 1963, which arose out of his turnaround from the missile crisis and from these experiences that we've already been going into, the Vietnam War and back at the Bay of Pigs. In the American University Address, he says that he wants to end the Cold War. That could be the basic summary of the whole thing, but he wants to do more than that. He wants to begin not only envisioning, but moving step by step into a disarmed world. And he wants to do that concretely with a guy named Nikita Khrushchev, his enemy. And Khrushchev read that speech, heard that speech. In fact, he put it all over the Soviet Union and all their radio and TV networks. And he said, this is the greatest speech a U.S. president has given to Roosevelt.
It absolutely was, you know, and you reprint the entire speech in JFK and the Unspeakable,
yes.
Why he died and why it matters. We're speaking with James W. Douglas about this really extraordinarily important book. Jim, talk to us about Kennedy's second experience in Cuba with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then let's talk about the back channel he opened up with Nikita Khrushchev afterwards.
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a deeply misunderstood part of our history because it's usually presented as Kennedy going to war with Khrushchev and winning, beating him, sort of 12 noon at the OK Corral and all that kind of stuff. That's really the opposite of the story. What really happened is that both Kennedy and Khrushchev realized they were in over their heads, and Kennedy especially, because his military people were pushing for a nuclear war. They wanted a nuclear war because the U.S. had far more missiles and warheads than the Soviet Union. The generals felt they could win. This is insanity, and that's what it was. And they pushed by sending missiles, even test-firing missiles in the midst of the missile crisis to try to get the Soviets to move in such a way that they could justify a preemptive attack on the Soviet Union. Well, Kennedy realized all this kind of incredible stuff was happening, and he appealed secretly to Khrushchev to help him get out of that mess that they had both gotten into. And when Khrushchev got this secret appeal that went through Robert Kennedy and the ambassador to the Soviet Union, Anatoly Dobrynin, and of course RFK was the Attorney General at the time, Khrushchev got this appeal and he said to his foreign minister, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And he almost couldn't believe what he was saying because, of course, that was his arch enemy. But he said, yes, we now have a common enemy to save the world from those pushing us toward war. And at that point, the whole thing, the whole Cold War turned upside down because Khrushchev and Kennedy became closer to each other than either was to his own military and industrial power system. That was a truly amazing point in all of our history.
Very few knew of this secret relationship.
That's true. And it had been going on. It didn't just happen in the middle of the missile crisis. The irony was that these two were struggling in a relentless way over the Cold War and very publicly. And at the same time, secretly, they had this correspondence going on where they were trying to get out of it. And they had the sense, both of them, to realize that they were engaged in a titanic battle that was could destroy the whole world. And they kept under the radar of their own systems by this secret correspondence. And we have that all available to us today, but historians ignore it because it doesn't fit with the public image.
It doesn't fit. That's why your book is a hidden history that's immaculately documented. It's an extremely important book. I urge all of our readers to get it. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Let's talk a second about what happened, the missile crisis, and then with Vietnam, because
sure.
I had thought about the missile crisis just the way you laid it out. And
yes.
then I also thought about Vietnam, that
yes.
that Kennedy had no intention of backing out of Vietnam, that he was steadily getting the United States involved. My whole preconception of Kennedy as a cold warrior was turned around by the documentation in your book, JFK and the Unspeakable. So talk for a moment, would you, about his notion about what the United States should do with respect to Vietnam and the national liberation movement that was going on there.
Well, I should say, too, Michael, I got turned around. I was very skeptical of Kennedy when he was alive, and I didn't understand any of this stuff when it was going on, and I didn't catch up to it for 30 years. So I've got that in common with everybody else. But anyhow, on Vietnam, Kennedy was drawn into it, and he didn't want to get involved in Vietnam. He made a very strong stand against involvement in Laos, and that typified his early resistance to his advisors after the Bay of Pigs. He negotiated a truce, a peace in Laos that involved negotiating with the communists in a coalition government. And so all his national security advisors were appalled by that. So they pushed for his involvement in Vietnam. And he conceded, he gave advisors to the state that had been set up with Diem, South Vietnam. It's a state that was basically U.S. created because we refused to allow the elections. Eisenhower refused to allow the elections that would have kept Vietnam as a single power and under the under Ho Chi Minh, who would have won the election easily. But anyhow, Kennedy, that's all prior to Kennedy, and Kennedy was going along with this to some degree because he couldn't beat his national security advisors everywhere, so he conceded advisors. But he wanted an exit policy, and his military people would not give him an exit policy. For a couple of years, he was insisting, saying, give me an exit policy. I want out of here, and I want you to tell me, you know, I want you to set it up so we can get out of here. So finally, in 63, McNamara simply ordered it, McNamara being Kennedy's defense secretary who was helping him, who tried to resist to some degree the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then Kennedy pushed through a national security memorandum, NSAM 263, which ended the Vietnam War by an order in terms of everybody out by 65 and 1,000 U.S. troops out by the end of 63. And none of that happened because that October NSAM 263 was voided very quietly as soon as Kennedy was killed in November. So he actually signed the withdrawal order from Vietnam before he was assassinated. And Lyndon Johnson turned it around 2 days after his assassination when he went with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the man in charge down there and out there in Vietnam. And Kennedy was about to fire him, and Lodge said, I'm not going to be the one who surrenders in Southeast Asia.
Jim, talking about the assassination, you
yes.
say that Kennedy knew
yes.
that he was going to die, and yet still had the fortitude, the moral fortitude, to stand up to the system. Talk a little bit about that.
He had this, what friends who were critical of it would call his obsession with death. It wasn't an obsession with death. It was a very realistic assessment that he was going to die, because if you walk a certain road, if you try to turn around a national security state that is dominating the world, most powerful force in the history of the world, and you try to do so as president of the United States, well, of course you're going to die. Either that, you're going to be thrown out of office by some kind of subversion process, some kind of a coup. And so Kennedy knew that. Now, Kennedy also had a certain awareness of death because of his experience in World War II, so I don't want to minimize that. But he had a very realistic assessment, and he knew when he was going to Dallas that this was probably it, and he was saying goodbye to people before he left, including especially his father and his dead son, whom he visited at his grave site. He did these things just a month before his assassination, and he also, there's an incredible scene that I described in the book where Caroline, his daughter, recites a poem to him in the midst of the National Security Council, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death." It's the most incredible moment. And at that moment, Kennedy was both communing with his daughter over his anticipation of his death, and saying, okay, if I have to, I have to, but I'm going to do this thing.
James W. Douglas is the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, a very, very important book. Jim, let's talk about history and turning points in history.
Yes.
and put this book in perspective. Had Kennedy not been killed, there would have been no massive loss of Vietnamese and American lives in Vietnam.
That's true.
Had he not been killed, there wouldn't have been a massive loss of lives of people in Indonesia.
That's true.
Because he was reaching out to Sukarno.
That's right.
Had he not been killed, there would have been nuclear disarmament.
That's true.
And it seems that, you know, history is not just this inexorable force, that at certain moments people can make their own history, you know, within certain limits, but can make their own history. And Kennedy was trying to do that. And that's what's so extraordinarily moving and sad and really shakes you up about coming to these realizations when you read your book.
Can I add one more, Michael?
Yeah.
Fidel Castro.
A very critical
player in this whole history.
I'm sorry that I forgot to ask you about that.
We wanted to ask about his relationship, too.
Yeah, Fidel Castro and JFK were getting together. That's the underline it, circle it. JFK and Fidel Castro were getting together. There is no question of that. It isn't even a maybe they were. They were definitely, and there were secret negotiations going on between them through intermediaries at the very moment that Kennedy was being killed. He had a guy named Jean Daniel, a very good French reporter, who was talking with Castro at the very moment that Kennedy was assassinated. And they had been together for 6 hours going over JFK's questions for Castro in a hotel a couple of days before, and they were having lunch together, Jean Daniel and Fidel, at the moment that JFK was killed. And when Fidel got the phone message and then the confirmation that JFK had died, he just said, "Everything has changed. Everything is going to change." And that is the truth. And to that, from that day to this, we still have not normalized relations with Cuba, which would have happened in, probably 64 to 65 if JFK had lived.
You also spoke about the murders of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy. And I understand you're going to be writing books on these.
That's true. It's all one story. The death of those four by the same forces in a period of 4.5 years from late 63 through mid 68, that's a story of the 60s. It's a story of the destruction, the deliberate destruction of hope, not much more so than any individual characters like the Kennedys or Malcolm X or MLK. It's the destruction of hope. It's the destruction of a vision of change. It's the destruction of a turning in this country and in the world, all of which was happening and had to be stopped by the forces that were behind. Well, that's what Merton sums up as the unspeakable, the forces that were behind the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and those assassinations.
I truly believe that.
It has been documented in various ways by various people, but it has to be put together. It's our story. It's our story.
Jim, I have to ask, how did you become interested in this topic and start doing your research on it?
Very specifically from Martin Luther King, not John Kennedy, but for Martin Luther King. When he was assassinated on April 4, 68, I was a professor in the religion department at the University of Hawaii, Honolulu, Manoa campus. And in our class, which was on the theology of peace, there were young men who, inspired by King giving his life, and they, as they understood it, and rightly so, to stop the Vietnam War, they didn't think it was... Yeah. James Earl Ray as any lone assassin that killed Martin Luther King. They understood it was deeper than that, and they thought it meant killing him, especially because he was trying to end the war and because he was trying to end poverty through the Poor People's Campaign. And so what they did, without my knowledge, was they had a little gathering, and they burned their draft cards, which meant some of them went to jail for 6 months, some for 2 years. I joined their group. We called it the Hawaii Resistance, and that was basically the end of my academic career.
That'll do it.
That did it, yeah. Well, I lasted a little while longer, but that was basically the end. And that meant I wanted to understand. That was my baptism into nonviolence, not as an academic topic for seminars, but as a way of life. And so now I'm a Catholic worker. We have a Catholic worker house, and we go to Iraq when we can. We do what we can, as you do, for real law, not disorder.
we're laboring in the same vineyards,
Douglas. So that changed my life. So ever since then, I've been trying to catch up to King's assassination. And in 99, I went to the only trial ever held for the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis. 6 weeks, 70 witnesses, and a verdict in a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, a verdict of yes, a conspiracy. This is a jury of 6 black and 6 white jurors, yes, it was conspiracy of U.S. government agencies. That's in their verdict. That's in their verdict.
Yeah.
U.S. government agencies killed Dr. Martin Luther King. In the verdict of a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, and the verdict came down December 8, 1999. How many people in the United States know about that today?
It's a hidden history, like the assassination investigation by the Congress said that there was another assassin, not just Oswald. So there was a conspiracy there, too. It's a hidden history.
It was King that sent me to Kennedy. It wasn't Kennedy. You know, through King, I could understand because we had the same politics and spirituality. John F. Kennedy, come on, you know. I had no sense that he was subject to the same thing, but he was.
I just urge people to go out and get James W. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. This is an Orbis book published in connection with the Marinol Brothers here in New York, very important publishing house, and they've done us a great, great service by publishing this book. James W. Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim, do you have any final thoughts you want to share with us?
Yeah, we're in the same scene right now, exactly the same scene. And what we saw going on last fall with Generals Petraeus and McChrystal setting up Obama, it's exactly the same as the Joint Chiefs of Staff setting up and the CIA setting up Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs. McChrystal, Petraeus, they were dictating terms to the president, and unlike Kennedy, he did not face them down. If he does face them down, as I hope he will in the future, he's going to be in the same position Kennedy was, and that's what he needs to be in. That's what we need to be in. We need to be way out ahead of Obama so that he can follow. You know, if the people lead, the the leader will follow. So we need to be out ahead of Obama, not waiting for him to do something. And if we get out ahead of him far enough, he will do something. He's a good person. And at that point, he's going to have to face down those generals, which is what Kennedy did. And we all have to face the music at that point.
Jim, I think that's excellent advice. And on that note, we want to thank you so much for this important contribution to our history, and hope that we have you back on again. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Heidi, thank you, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.